You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has experienced a number of COVID-19 surges since March, and no location or age group has been left out. A new WisContext report tells the story of the spread of the disease here in the state. Now, 48 attorneys general and the Federal Trade Commission each filed antitrust lawsuits against Facebook this week. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joined the suit filed by states, saying in a statement that, quote, Facebook's market power and tactics have meant less privacy and less choice for consumers, as well as less tech innovation, quote. Among the issues raised in the suits, Facebook's acquisition of former competitors Instagram and WhatsApp. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Facebook is too big, especially when you throw in Instagram and other former competitors it bought over the years? Do you like the idea of state and or federal government stepping in to regulate it? What kind of changes would you like to see? What questions do you have about how this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Matthew Minton is professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School, where he also teaches antitrust law. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, we've got this set of lawsuits, a lot of common threads between them. At the heart of them, what kind of arguments are we seeing from the Federal Trade Commission and from these attorneys general about what is wrong at Facebook?
Well, the attorney general's lawsuits, you know, basically claim that Facebook has a monopoly in personal social network marketing in the United States. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, having a monopoly. But the question is, how did you acquire it and what are you doing to maintain it? And the allegations are essentially that Facebook has, adopted an effort, as they're describing in the complaint, tried to build a competitive moat around the company, and that the company's CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, has a reputation for, quote, wielding Facebook's power as a sword, which Section 2 of the Sherman Act prohibits. That's part of the federal antitrust laws, and it's designed to maintain a level playing field. And the claim is essentially that, you know, the acquisition of Instagram, WhatsApp, another company, Inovo, and some other things are really designed to further that monopoly. It chills innovation because there's not the competitive threat from others. And as a result, consumers are worse off.
Let's talk about that consumers being worse off angle, because an everyday Facebook user and maybe Instagram user too might say, hey, I use these social media platforms. I'm happy with the options out there for me. So why punish this company for creating / buying things that I like to use?
Well, the question would be, would there be, you know, even better options that would be out there? Or if the allegation is that if Facebook wasn't trying to keep, harm its actual competitors or those who could potentially compete with it, there would be more innovation and there would be greater control that users of Facebook had over, you know, who would have access to various things. And there would be greater protection of privacy. So it's the idea being that, you know, even if at least some or most people are happy with currently what they get from Facebook, they might be even happier if, these things can engage in this alleged anti-competitive conduct.
We are talking to Matthew Minton, professor of law and executive director of the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University Law School. He teaches antitrust law there, and we're talking about two different lawsuits being brought against Facebook, one by attorneys general from many states, bipartisan group that includes Wisconsin, one from the Federal Trade Commission looking for changes at Facebook. Matthew, what kind of remedies are these lawsuits seeking? What changes do they want to see happen?
Well, the state attorney general's lawsuit, it's rather broad. They want first the court to determine, one, that Facebook engaged in illegal monopolization in violation of Section 2 of the Sherman Act, that the Instagram and WhatsApp acquisitions violated another part of the federal antitrust laws, Clayton Act Section 7, which prohibits any acquisitions which may have the effect of tending to create a monopoly, and broadly asked that there be a restoration of competitive conditions, including, you know, any divestiture of Facebook assets or business lines that the court deems necessary to do so. And then the other thing is they're asking the court for an order that anytime Facebook is considering acquiring a company for a price of more than $10 million, they can notify the state's attorney general so they could raise any objections to it.
We are talking about lawsuits against Facebook with Matt Mitten from Marquette Law School. Two antitrust lawsuits filed against Facebook this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Do you think there should be these lawsuits? Do you want changes at Facebook? Do you feel like they're engaged in anti-competitive behavior? If so, what remedy do you want to see? If not, make the case that this shouldn't go ahead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Marquette University Law School Professor Matt Mitten, looking at antitrust lawsuits filed against Facebook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions about how this all works and your thoughts about whether you think Facebook has amassed too much power and is engaging in anti-competitive behavior. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to a caller now. Tina is with us in Kenosha. Tina, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, I've got a couple of things. First of all, I think his argument is flawed because of the fact that most of the time, one side of the coin is less government on anything. We don't even have a national health care. Yet government goes after a platform of social media, which I find quite interesting considering how it connects people all over the globe. And as far as stifling creativity, I don't think Facebook has done that, number one, because anybody can create another platform and have, and whether people gravitate to that or not is what people will do. That's my point.
Thanks a lot for the call. Let's take those points one at a time. Matt, Tina feels like this particular social media sector of the economy is getting a lot of attention where the government isn't aggressively pursuing other sectors of the economy with antitrust action.
Yeah, I think I would first point out that she used the word he is advocating, and I'm not advocating anything. I'm just describing the, you know, allegations by the, you know, 47 or 48 state attorneys general. I mean, I'm as a law professor, I'm not asked my opinion as to, and I wasn't on this suit, as to whether this suit should be brought or not. But, you know, I think the first, you know, one of the points that she made is that, well, you know, anyone can set up something like this. And, you know, that really isn't true. That might have been the case back around the time when, you know, Facebook was created, which is, I think, 2004, and it overtook MySpace. But now, because of something known as network effects, it's just that once you get more and more people on here, and there are, you know, what would the allegations are that about half of the adults in the U.S. are on this, that you have to get a certain huge, huge core group and, you know, to set up a competing personal social, you know, networking market in the U.S. And then people, once they get familiar with something, there's what's known as switching costs to switch over to a competing thing. And when you've got, you know, hundreds or even thousands of connections, friends and family that people do, that makes it pretty difficult to do. So it's not as easy, not as simple as just, well, someone else can start up, you know, an online platform and effectively compete with Facebook.
And another point here, we've talked about Facebook buying potential characters. People have talked about, competitors. People have talked about buy or bury. Facebook using its leverage to, for a while, allow a potential competitor to work through Facebook and then shutting them down, in effect. That's another part of these lawsuits, right?
Yeah, very much so. The idea is, you know, one of the key acquisitions was a company called Anavo that had the ability to track which applications were gaining traction. So once you find out that, hey, this is potentially a competitive threat, try to buy them and acquire them. Or if they don't do that, try to, deprive, an actual or potential competitor of resources that they would need to compete with Facebook. Now, one thing I think that's important to keep in mind is, back to this principle, there's nothing wrong. Facebook initially, became the, predominant personal social networking market here in the U.S. because it offered better innovation and other features than MySpace did. And that's perfectly fine. And it's okay as long as, Facebook is, enhancing its own capacity for innovation, quality, that sort of thing. Back to the idea that, Section 2 is designed to maintain a level playing field. You can't do anything to use that power to keep others out of the market and from competing with you. And that's the thing that's being challenged here.
Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Bob on the line in Westby. Bob, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Bob?
The point I would bring up, I am not on Facebook, Instagram, or WhatsApp. But and I would certainly agree that they've become a monopoly. The problem I face is that it seems to me the Sherman Act was in effect back in 2012 when Facebook was given permission to acquire these other companies. And they might indeed have gotten it wrong at that time, but it seems to me the government made a commitment to allow them to buy those companies at that time.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a point, Matt, that Facebook is definitely making. You approved it then. No backsies. Why is, the law isn't any different now than it was when you approved these buyouts?
Well, that's true. The law is the same. The federal antitrust laws, which are, the provision that this suit's being brought under has not changed. But it was the federal government that provided approval. Now, you've got two arms, the Federal Trade Commission, as well as the, antitrust division, which is part of the Department of Justice. And it got approval from, they typically work together, and that approval was given. But I think it's probably likely that the antitrust division approved it. The FTC might not have. And so they wouldn't be precluded from bringing their suit. But probably more importantly, and this goes to the relief that the 47 state attorney generals are asking for. They said, look, we weren't asked about whether we wanted, we weren't given notice of this and didn't have an opportunity to challenge it then. So their claim is, and that is one of the things, you can have, state entities after the fact challenging an acquisition that the federal government entities charged with enforcing the antitrust laws think was okay at the time. And then if there's a dispute between various states that we have here and perhaps the federal government, I didn't get a chance to take a close look at the FTC suit, then it's going to be up to a court to resolve it.
Let's bring on another caller now. Aaron is with us in Oshkosh. Aaron, hello.
Hey, everyone. Thank you very much for taking my call. It's a very interesting topic. I, of course, always appreciate everyone on the public radio side making the show possible. I basically have three points to make, and I'll be as clear and concise as possible. Point number one, capitalism. Participate in it or don't. And after that, to link Facebook towards my life experience, back in the 90s, Bill Gates cost me $37,000 by squashing a stock that I was invested in long enough so they could launch their own Microsoft Office platform that would integrate your emails, your faxes, and your other inter-office communiques. Then, in the 90s, they pulled Bill Gates before Congress and tried to get him with all this monopoly stuff, and I said, leave him alone. That's
Aaron,
capitalism.
Thanks a lot for the call. Matt, that's capitalism. That's how business works, Aaron says, even though he was on the losing end of that particular exchange.
Well, in the U.S., we don't have laissez-faire capitalism where it's anything goes. I mean, we do have federal antitrust laws that have been around since the late 1800s. And, you know, certainly the interpretation of them, you know, change over time. There's no question about that. But the bottom line is any company that does business in the United States has to comply with them. So you can't, I mean, again, it's okay to, you know, even a very large company, someone with monopoly power, they are, in fact, they're encouraged to engage in free, fair competition on the merits. But you got to make sure that competitor, you're not doing what's characterized as illegal, predatory, or exclusionary conduct to drive out competitors. And again, I'm not advocating for or against any of the allegations in this lawsuit. I just read it through. It's a very lengthy complaint for the first time, and I'm just trying to provide a very balanced perspective of some of the allegations. And, you know, Facebook is going to allege, hey, this is just all fair competition on the merits. We are not doing anything that hurts consumers or that prevents anyone from competing against us.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. We'll go to Mark with us now in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi. I was listening to your conversation, and I'm not sure that we can classify Facebook as a monopoly. I know that word has been getting thrown around. The business is communications, and there are other platforms out there to communicate, whether it's telephone, email, landlines, using the post office. There's lots of ways to communicate, of which Facebook is just one of them. Now, that may not excuse their behavior as being predatory, but I don't think we can capitalize or label them as a monopoly. And that's what I wanted to say.
Mark, thanks for the call. It's an interesting thought, Matt. How do courts look at that idea of defining what the sector is in the first place? Is Facebook a monopoly in social media, or is it just one of many alternatives of communication?
Well, Mark raises a very good point, because the first element is we have to ask, does Facebook have monopoly power in a properly defined relevant market, is the terminology used. And it's got both a product and product or service component as well as a geographical component. And what's being alleged in this complaint is that there aren't any reasonable substitutes from the perspective of consumers for what Facebook offers. The claim is that this is a, quote, unique online communication service. It's even distinct from something like, you know, LinkedIn, which is used mainly on the business side, or texting, or any other forms of communication. The allegation is that what makes this unique is that there's not any reasonable substitute as a way to post photos, to get in touch, you know, instantaneously with, you know, a couple hundred or even a couple thousand family members and friends. So that will be, you know, one of the issues that the court's going to have to resolve is this personal social networking market. Is that the appropriate relevant service market? And then the other claim is that, you know, any other, you know, similar network outside the United States is not reasonably interchangeable, because apparently it's just people are on this largely to connect with those within their home country. So you're going to have to get, you know, some experts, some perhaps consumer surveys. This is a very complicated issue that I think will be, you know, very hotly contested by both sides.
In our last minute or so, Matt, I want to ask you to predict an outcome, but how long could it take for a case like this to resolve through the courts?
Well, particularly now during the pandemic, with a lot of courts having been shut for many months, and they're coming back very slowly, and as the COVID-19 infection rates ramp up, I don't think this is going to be resolved for probably at least 2 years in the trial court, and then depending upon which way it comes out, it'll almost certainly get appealed, and then maybe might go on to Supreme Court discretionary review. I would say if the state attorney generals can prove what they're alleging in the lawsuit, they will win. The real question is going to be, what's the remedy? Because the court, would at motion, they just enjoin, the conduct that resulted, that hurt consumers, but yet you don't want to tie Facebook's hands so much that they can't engage in fair competition on the merits. And those are always really impossible to predict until you actually see the evidence that comes out in the case.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Matthew Minton is a professor of law at Marquette University Law School, where he teaches antitrust law. We talked to him today about Facebook facing two new antitrust lawsuits, one from the Federal Trade Commission, one from attorneys general from a number of states, including Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll check out a WisConText report on the recent COVID-19 surge in Wisconsin. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a state court has ruled against another lawsuit from the Trump campaign. We'll get the latest on the efforts to overturn Wisconsin's election results. First, we've been in this pandemic for 9 months, long enough for some patterns to emerge as we look back to March. While the vaccine is getting closer and closer to distribution, communities across the state will be dealing with the virus for months to come yet. A new report from WisContext tracks the spread of the disease from the earliest days to now. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisContext. His most recent piece is called Wisconsin Spring, Summer, and Fall COVID-19 Surges. Will, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thank you.
Before we get into your new report and your data visualization there, how is Wisconsin doing right now when it comes to our latest COVID cases and the spread of the disease?
Sure. Well, cases are, well, cases, hospitalizations, and deaths due to COVID-19 have been trending down in Wisconsin over the last week to 2 weeks, although the spread is still quite high. There's still a high number of cases being reported every day. Today, that number was over 3,800, as well as a pretty high number of deaths being reported every day. And today, that number was 47. And the seven-day averages for both cases and deaths remain at levels that are higher than at almost any point in the pandemic, pretty much since or preceding late November.
Right. We hit a peak there and we're going down a little bit from that. And that's good news. But if you told us a couple of months ago where we were going to be today, that would look pretty bad. Is that a fair way to sum things up?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair way to sum things up. And just the fact that we're still dealing with thousands of new cases every day means that the potential for spread and for cases to rise again is quite high. So I think no one is quite at the point of relaxing yet or really anytime soon.
Well, let's get into your latest work on wiscontext.org, trying to put this into context. You've got some really interesting visualizations. Again, people can check this out at wiscontext.org. What did you set out to try to accomplish and explain with this latest project?
Sure. So I guess first I'll just say you're talking to a pretty visual learner. so I'm kind of myself automatically attracted to data visualizations. And one of the things that I personally really like about them is that you can convey a lot of information really succinctly. And as you said at the beginning of this segment, we're now 9 months into the pandemic, and there is a ton of new data coming out on a daily basis. So there's just a ton of data to go through. And we were interested in kind of looking back over at the pandemic over its course over the first 9 months and trying to suss out any patterns that we're seeing on a kind of a county or community level and spread when and where cases are rising.
Some of the talk early on in this, Will, as it hit New York, and then when it came to the Midwest, COVID did, it was in the cities, you know, Chicago, Milwaukee. And the thought was, okay, maybe this is a disease that's a high population density disease. And look at your visualizations, that might have made sense at first. Can you talk about what we see when we look at how this progressed over time?
Right, yeah. So these data visualizations, they're kind of colloquially known as bar chart races. And what they do, we've created an animated graphic that measures the number of total cases in every Wisconsin county over the course of the pandemic and adjusted for population. And as you said, at the beginning of the pandemic, the spread in the disease really was quite focused in the state's population centers. So Milwaukee, greater kind of southeastern Wisconsin, the Dane County area, Brown County, et cetera. But really, over the last several months, basically since the beginning of fall, what we've seen is the spread of the disease, as I think people who have been following it closely know at this point, has really become a lot more widespread and has it's really all throughout Wisconsin now. It is no longer a strictly kind of urban disease or high population density disease. It's all over the place. And in fact, some of the counties dealing with worse outbreaks are Wisconsin's rural counties right now.
And in the various, what do you call them, bar chart races? Is that, that's what they're called?
Yeah, that's the official term, I guess.
Yeah, so you color code them. And in this case, what we're talking about is counties by their population. And you can really see that stark change. You also did one by region of the state and split the state up into, based on their a hospital classification, I think. Talk about that and what we learn when we look at it that way.
Right. So when we color-coded counties by their hospital region, really we did that because those regions are frankly just a good proxy for Wisconsin's general geographic regions. But they're also really important during the pandemic because these regions are areas where the healthcare systems share resources. So when the disease is really bad in a specific region, it could strain healthcare resources across that region. And looking at the growth in cases across the state through that lens, you really see a shift in these last few months of the disease from kind of being focused around mostly around southeastern Wisconsin to, as I think people are probably aware, kind of the Fox Valley region in northeast Wisconsin. And then most recently spreading a little bit more in north central and western Wisconsin.
We are talking to Will Cushman from WisContext, talking about work he's been doing at WisContext.org, visualizing the progress, the spread of COVID-19 here in Wisconsin, and watching these things play out, Will, which people can do again online at WisContext.org. I mean, I remember hearing when this started to be a big thing in the Fox Cities and in Green Bay. And really just seeing that happen day by day on your charts was really very striking. I think in a way that just the words don't really describe.
Exactly. And I think that's really the power and usefulness of these data visualizations. As you said, I think people are pretty aware, if you've been following the news related to COVID in Wisconsin, about where it's spreading and how badly it's spreading in certain areas. But when you visualize it in this way, it really is quite striking to see those patterns. And also, in my opinion, to see those patterns, see the rise in cases be so quick in some places. It's really quite astonishing.
Now, in addition to region and population, what other kind of things, what other things did you plug in to color code this and learn more about the spread?
We sorted counties by their median age. And this was really to try to gain a grasp of
community's risk to the disease as it's spread around Wisconsin. We know that one of the biggest risk factors for serious disease and death is age, advanced age. And what we find, and it also is not necessarily surprising, but I think it's interesting, that as the disease has spread into more rural parts of the state, it's also spreading to generally older parts of the state as well. And so communities that are arguably at higher risk for serious disease.
You also looked at the presence of prisons in communities.
Yes.
So what did you learn when you looked at it that way?
Yes. So looking at the rise in cases through some of these lenses, like hospital region, population, a county's rural or urban status, or median age, didn't necessarily account for some of the really steep rises in cases that we were seeing in some of these counties. And what we found is that in several of these counties that saw just really rapid just explosions in cases per capita have a either state or federal prison, for the most part a state prison located in that county. We've seen that in a number of places: Sheboygan County, Winnebago County, Jackson, most recently in Crawford County, where a really pretty bad outbreak has been spreading through the prison in Prairie du Chien.
And Will, as we wrap up, what are you going to be working on next when it comes to ways to understand the spread of COVID-19 in Wisconsin?
Sure. We are going to be looking pretty closely at some of the demographic disparities in the disease. So looking at disparities based on race and ethnicity in the state, as well as disparities that we're seeing based on age. So I would say be prepared to see that on our site sometime next week.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
Will Cushman is associate editor of WisContext. His most recent piece is Wisconsin Spring, Summer, and Fall COVID-19 Surges. You can find a link to that and take a look at the graphics we've been talking about. You can find that at WPR.org/Central Time. We've got a link right there. Coming up, one ruling in, one ruling to go, and probably some appeals as well. We'll check in on where things stand with lawsuits challenging Wisconsin's election results. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the British are first in line for a shot in the arm. Canada says it won't be far behind. And climbing Mount Everest has just become an even taller order. Hear about those stories and more on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a state court and a federal court heard arguments yesterday and today in two lawsuits brought by the Trump campaign challenging the results of the election in Wisconsin. And one of those cases, which seeks to toss out over 200,000 absentee votes in Dane and Milwaukee counties, a Racine County judge ruled against the president, affirming Joe Biden's victory in the state. The campaign's lawyers have appealed that decision. Another suit in federal court hopes to toss out the state's results altogether and give the legislature the power to pick Wisconsin's electors. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking. The Electoral College meets on Monday to cast votes for the next president. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's been on court watch this week. Sean, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, let's start with this state court case brought by the Trump campaign. It hinges on Dane and Milwaukee counties, their recount and guidance that local clerks got from the Elections Commission. Tell us about this case and what happened today.
Yeah, this came from the recount that the Trump campaign asked for in Dane and Milwaukee counties, where they challenged these groups of absentee voters, totaling more than 220,000 absentee voters in those counties specifically. After the recount was over, the Trump campaign challenged the results before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said in a 4-3 ruling, look, you have to file this in circuit court first. So they did that. They sent it to Dane and Milwaukee County Circuit Courts. That got combined by the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court into a Racine County courtroom, where the judge, Stephen Simanek, ruled that, essentially affirming that the recount showed that Joe Biden had won Wisconsin. He dismissed all of the Trump campaign's arguments, which were not about specific allegations of fraud or specific allegations that voters had done anything wrong, but were rather allegations that clerks in those counties followed bad guidance from the Wisconsin Elections Commission when it came to handling absentee ballots. Some of that guidance had been on the books for 10 years. A lot of it was on the books when President Trump ran and won in Wisconsin in 2016. And so the judge said, you know, there was nothing wrong with that guidance. He upheld the election results, and that gave the Trump campaign a case to appeal.
And they're appealing, and I guess there's some fresh news on that, Sean.
Yeah, they're appealing, and right before we started to talk here, the Supreme Court announced that it will hear an expedited appeal of that case. So essentially, that lets it bypass the Court of Appeals and go directly to the Supreme Court. And justices are going to hear arguments in that case on Saturday at noon, which never, ever happens, and gives you an example of, you know, how time is of the essence in these cases.
Now, let's talk more about this initial judge's reaction to this challenge. The gist, as you said, it seems like, Sean, these rules were in place. Everybody knew the rules coming to the election. The judge said, why did you wait till after we have a result to challenge these instead of challenging these rules, again, that have existed for years? Is that part of why this was rejected by the circuit court?
He didn't really get into the timing aspect of it, you know, because that is a pretty key argument against the Trump campaign's lawsuits, not only in Wisconsin, but elsewhere. You know, that if you're challenging specific procedures in election law, there's this latches doctrine they talk about in court where, you know, you need to challenge them before the election and not after. He didn't get into that. He basically just said that there was nothing wrong with the guidance. You know, for example, Trump is challenging 170,000 absentee ballots that were cast by people in person before Election Day. So this is commonly referred to as early voting. And he's saying, you know, they didn't fill out the same absentee ballot application that other voters fill out. But they do fill out a form of an application that has been endorsed by Wisconsin elections officials for a decade now. And so the judge dismissed that. He also dismissed the Trump campaign's challenge to voters who said they were indefinitely confined. And so when you say you're indefinitely confined, you don't have to produce a photo ID in order to get an absentee ballot. You know, the judge said that he can't just, you know, strike those ballots down based on some type of a suggestion, an inference that there was wrongdoing there. He said it's, you know, more likely that people were rightly concerned about going out and voting during the COVID-19 pandemic. So he dismissed it all relatively quickly. You know, he heard arguments in the case, ruled from the bench, and teed up this, this state Supreme Court case again.
Now let's head to the Supreme Court. They had rejected the suit and sent it back down to a lower court initially, partly on the basis that that's how the procedure is supposed to work. Did justices tip their hands that much in that ruling on the merits of the case that is now actually going before them tomorrow?
So I wouldn't say they tipped their hands much in that case, but there have now been three cases that have been filed directly to the state Supreme Court where they've been asked in different ways to overturn the results of Wisconsin's election. And in another one of the cases filed by a group that goes by the name of the Wisconsin Voters Alliance, this is a lawsuit that was filed with help from an organization called the Thomas More Society, which is a conservative law firm based out of Chicago. In that case, you heard Justice Brian Hagedorn issue scathing, blistering, you know, however you want to describe it, opinion, where he said that, you know, what the plaintiffs were asking the court to do was really an unprecedented act of judicial power, the likes he had never seen before. So the Trump campaign's lawsuit is more specific than those other lawsuits that the state Supreme Court rejected on 4-3 votes. But the outcome would be the same. That is, the Trump campaign is asking the court to step in and strike hundreds of thousands of votes and change the outcome of the election from a Joe Biden victory to a Donald Trump victory.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about the latest on court cases seeking to overturn Wisconsin's presidential election result. Let's spend a little time now in federal court, Sean, and we're all eagerly watching, I think, for a ruling there. What's going on?
We are. So there have been a couple lawsuits filed in Wisconsin federal courtrooms. One of them was dismissed by a judge, Judge Pamela Pepper, who said that she didn't have the, you know, the standing, the jurisdiction basically to strike down a state election result as a federal judge. You know, that was not allowed under the U.S. Constitution. And I mean, her ruling really focused on that was not her place. It was not an option she had as a federal judge. There is a second lawsuit. This one was filed by the Trump campaign. There were hours of hearings yesterday, and that's the one where we're waiting on the decision. This case is being handled by U.S. District Court Judge Brett Ludwig. He is a Trump appointee, and you know, we don't know how he's going to rule, but we know he said some skeptical stuff about this lawsuit. You know, he said, for example, yesterday he thought it was incredible that Trump waited to file the Wisconsin lawsuit until after the election. So here we're getting into the timing aspect of it. Waited to file it until after the election when these elections procedures had been in place for years.
Now, the Electoral College is scheduled to vote on Monday, Sean. So time is of the essence on all of these cases.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right, which is why you see the state Supreme Court is taking the rare step of holding arguments on a Saturday. We don't know when this federal judge is going to issue a decision in Wisconsin's federal case. We also have a huge case which involves Wisconsin before the U.S. Supreme Court, filed by the state of Texas, which, you know, the president has really latched onto there. I mean, he's basically saying this is the big one. And so he's asking the U.S. Supreme Court to reverse the results of the election in four states that supported Joe Biden and send those elections to the Republican legislatures in those states instead.
And Sean, I'm always hesitant, as you know, to use the word unprecedented, but we're getting pretty close here, right, on these calls to flip an election result in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we can use it. I think we can use that word unprecedented. You know, you heard Justice Hagedorn, use it in his opinion the other day in that state case. And yes, you have state attorneys general, Republican state attorneys general, lining up behind the president and Republican members of Congress, including U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany of Wisconsin, lining up behind the president, supporting his effort to overturn election results. So, yes, we have not seen this before, and certainly not in our lifetimes.
Sean, thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He got us up to speed on the latest lawsuits from the Trump campaign challenging Wisconsin's election results. A state judge ruled against the president in one of those cases today, now headed to the state Supreme Court tomorrow, and a decision from a federal court in another case expected whenever, anytime now. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7, it's the State Capitol Report. Kate talks to a new Republican co-chair of a key budget committee. And then Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes joins the show for a look at a state climate change task force. That's Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then spending the holidays apart from our families can be especially tough on older relatives. We'll talk about ways to get creative with how we keep in touch this year and come up with new ideas for the holidays to make everyone feel more connected. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.